Good morning, and welcome to week two. This is a good time to remind everybody to turn off their phones. Perfect. Thank you. I appreciate that. We started on the abortion topic last week, and we have to finish it up. And as I said in the email that I sent out the other day, I apologize. I think overpacked last week's. I bit off too much. It's a big topic, and we said that last week, and I gave you links for recordings online where I've talked about the topic in greater depth. But I still needed to make it a little more concise than we did last week. But basically what we said was the following. We talked about an approach to Jewish bioethics in which one would look for biblical verses and see the basis for the law biblically, then see the rabbinical positions on the different sides of the ethical issues that are involved, see how the rabbis resolve the issue. And you can do that for a topic like abortion, because there is a ton of material and there's a lot of legal discussion of the topic. What we're going to see in the second half today, cosmetic surgery, is actually going to be a very different topic that's going to require a different approach. But we'll see that when we get there. There's a phrase in Hebrew, some of you may be familiar, Daya Litzara Bishata, which means it's enough to deal with one problem when you have it. You don't need to looking for trouble. So let's deal with one problem first, and then we'll deal with the other problem later. But I do want to just give a quick summary of what we saw regarding abortion. So we saw two apparently contradictory biblical sources. On the one hand, the statement that a person who commits murder receives capital punishment. On the other hand, we saw that in the event that a man strikes a pregnant woman and she loses the fetus, he pays for what he has done. There is some kind of financial penalty. We did not get into the specifics of how the number is established, what the dollar amount is. But we said that that's inconsistent. If you believe that murder gets capital punishment, why is this person paying instead of being executed? Does that mean that the fetus is not actually a life at all? This is a little bit of a digression, the following statement, but I just had this conversation with somebody yesterday afternoon, and I think it's worth thinking about. We came to the conclusion that if you're going to tell me that abortion does not carry capital punishment, which it doesn't, that must mean the fetus is not truly a life. Right? That must be the conclusion. So someone pointed out to me yesterday a case in Wyoming in which anyone heard about this case? The case in Wyoming in which a man killed his pregnant girlfriend, and the rule in Wyoming is that one cannot get capital punishment for killing one person, but one can get it for killing two people. And the prosecutor is arguing that he killed two people. That's the prosecutor's argument. To which he responds, if abortion is legal, clearly it's not a life, and therefore he has only killed one person. That's his response. So I wonder a little bit, now that Canada has accepted, better or worse, and I believe worse, but we'll talk about that, the issue of medical assistance in dying, even though there is absolutely no question that the person who is receiving this is a full-blown life, the argument they're not making the argument this person is not truly alive. They're making the argument that murder under certain circumstances is not murder. Right, that's the argument they're making. And I wonder about applying that back to abortion now. Meaning, for 40-plus years, the legal grounds for abortion has been that the fetus isn't truly alive yet. But I wonder if you now go back and say, now that the law has recognized the theory that something can be alive and yet you're allowed to end it, whether that's in fact the argument to justify abortion and not the argument the fetus isn't alive. I don't know. This requires some discussion and thought. I just threw it out there because I think that it's a very interesting question for lawyers to debate. But going back to our discussion, the general assumption is, as we said last week, that if the Torah says that the penalty is not capital punishment, that must mean the fetus is not truly fully alive, and therefore abortion is not an act of murder. So then the question is, what is it? And we saw competing Talmudic sources. We saw some sources that indicate the fetus is indeed a full life. So for example, we said, if the fetus's life is in danger on Shabbat, We would break Shabbat in order to save it, just like we would save anybody on Shabbat. That indicates that it's a full-blown life. On the other hand, as an example, we saw a Talmudic text which said that until 40 days, the fetus is considered maya ba'alma, mere fluid, mere liquid. Hopefully everyone saw the follow-up email that I sent out last week, going into the discussion of why 40 days, where they got 40 days from. One, in terms of the idea of, as we had talked about in class, the development of the fetus, but the other being the large percentage of pregnancies that are lost in the first 6 weeks, and the idea that it has no presumed status of being alive until you've passed a certain threshold. Why that threshold? Why 6 weeks in particular is a good question, especially as we don't really know about a lot of the pregnancies that end in the first few weeks. People aren't even aware that conception had taken place. There's what to be said about that. But the bottom line out of this debate and this throwing back and forth of sources was that you have a position that says, I'm working from most lenient to most stringent. So you have the most lenient position that says that, you're right, it's not a life. And in fact, from a Jewish law perspective, you could make the argument that abortion would not be prohibited except that there's a biblical prohibition for non-Jews to engage in this. We gave the source for that last week. And therefore, it has to be prohibited for Jews, because there's no such thing as God saying non-Jews aren't allowed to do this, but Jews are allowed to. That doesn't exist within our Torah. You don't, things don't become easier when you become Jewish. That's the most lenient take on this, which may even make it a rabbinic prohibition as opposed to a biblical one. Then we move from that to the view that it's simply inappropriate behavior. The Torah is filled with general rules like, you shall be holy, you shall do that which is just and good, you shall walk in the ways of God, and this is inconsistent with that. Then, more strictly, we have the view that said, this is an act of wounding, which may be interpreted as an act of wounding the fetus, or an act of wounding the mother. And then the most severe is the view that this is some form of murder and it just doesn't carry the death penalty with it. So you went from one extreme, which is it really wouldn't be prohibited except non-Jews aren't allowed to do it, so Jews aren't allowed to do it either, all the way up to saying this is basically murder, even if it doesn't carry capital punishment, and a gamut of opinions in between. So what I wanted to do today is follow that up by talking about how these different views affect the application of the rules on abortion. So if you adopt the view, I'm working my way down now from the most strict perspective, if you adopt the view that Rabbi Moshe Feinstein did, we mentioned him last week, Rabbi Feinstein was one of the leading, if not the leading authority in Jewish law in North America, in the middle of the 20th century till he passed away in 1986. He is of the view that it is in fact murder. So he says, you can't override that other than threat to the mother's health. And you can interpret threat to the mother's health in different ways. He dealt with it on the most literal and basic level, threat to her physical life. He did not address this in terms of emotional pain, although we will talk about that in a little bit. He did address it, but only tangentially. If you adopt the view that it's about wounding the fetus, on the other hand, then you may well have justification in certain cases to override the prohibition. So take a look at source number one. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg is a key figure in this whole debate. We're going to come back to him shortly, and you'll see just how important his position is. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg passed away, I believe, in 2003. He was a leading authority in Jewish law in Israel, and in particular medical Jewish law, Jewish medical ethics. It's kind of an odd story. It's a funny story. The Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Israel has an official rabbi on staff. The rabbi on staff in the latter part of the 20th century, until the mid-80s, was Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss. Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss was a Hungarian halachic authority who then escaped the war and ended up in England, was the head of what would be called the Haredi community in England. and then made Aliyah and ended up in Israel for the last years of his life. And he was the halachic authority for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. He was the rabbi for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. However, as the story has been told to me by rabbis who were there, he wasn't the one you often went to with your question. Instead, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg had the synagogue across the street, and very often the rabbis would go to him. So much so that when I first started studying Jewish medical ethics, I was under the impression Rabbi Waldenberg was the rabbi of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. But it wasn't true. He was just the one that he got a lot of the questions. So he deals with this issue, and he takes the position which is in source number one. This is pulled from the middle of a long responsum, which is why it's not quite so clear as a standalone. I'll explain. There's a text found in Tosfot. Tosfot is an anthology of commentaries to the Talmud going back to the 12th and 13th centuries. And there's a comment that's found in one of these comments in Tosfot, which says, in a certain case, you're allowed to kill a fetus. So he explains that comment of, you may do this, which sounds very lenient. He says it may mean that one is not liable at all under the law of murder. But Tosfot agrees that it is prohibited as wounding. It's not murder, like Rabbi Feinstein says. Rather, abortion is an act of wounding the fetus specifically, and therefore one may not kill it without another human need. That is the key part of this line. He's telling you that there may well be a human need which will justify this act of wounding. Right? We justify wounding all the time. We justify wounding all the time. Right? A friend of mine mentioned to me that he has an elderly relative who has a gangrene situation in his foot, and they're going to need to do surgery, and they need to take out the tissue. Hopefully they can save the foot. But the statement that he's making, right, is that we may well justify wounding somebody in the interest of preserving his health. Right? So there is a justification of wounding in that case. The question is, how far do you go? What about wounding one party in order to help somebody else? Right? There's a risk of harm to the mother, or there's actual harm to the mother. You could abort the fetus in order to save the mother. That's the key question. By the way, I was in such a rush to get started, I forgot to note that our learning, in addition to the normal dedication of the series, there's an additional one for today, in loving memory of Elaine's father, Tzvi Hirsch Ben Chaya Bishlomo Halevi. Shem Hashem and Aliyah. That would be a view that suggests that the issue is the issue of wounding the fetus, and therefore maybe sometimes it's justified. What if I take the view that that the problem of abortion is about wounding the mother? Then that offers up even more leniency. Right? If the issue of abortion is the fetus is considered part of the mother, and by killing the fetus, you are effectively wounding the mother, that offers up even more grounds for leniency. See, if you're going to tell me the prohibition is about wounding the fetus, I'll say, we generally don't want you to wound party A in order to help party B. But if the whole issue of abortion is not about the fetus is just part of the mother, and the issue is that when you abort, you harm the mother, well, then we certainly do, like in the case of an amputation. We wound in order to help somebody. And cases that are less dire than an amputation. You follow what I'm saying? Is that clear? So you're open to much more justification for abortion. And then finally, if you take the most lenient view, that in fact the whole thing is rabbinic, well, in that case, we have justification for overriding rabbinic legislation all the time. So the question, you need to know why abortion is prohibited, what the rule is, in order to understand the application. So we're going to give two applications here for this to show the legal debate on this. The first case is abortion of a fetus with a Tay-Sachs diagnosis. And this has been an issue going back to the 70s, the early 70s, when they were able to determine late in the pregnancy that they were dealing with Tay-Sachs. We know how terrible this is, the pain that and the suffering involved for the child as well as for the family. The child, I think at this point, even the current state of medicine is still not making it past the age of 5 or 6. Is that correct? I think even that is considered late. So will you say, we know where things are going. We know the state of medical technology. We know that all we're doing by allowing this child to go to term is creating pain and suffering for the child, for the parents, for the rest of the family. Would we be willing to say that in such a case abortion is justified? I want to be sure to mention what I said in the beginning last time as well. Nothing we say here should be taken as glib or these are terribly painful decisions that families make, and I'm certainly not going to judge any decision that any family in this kind of a position ever makes. But extreme view number one is abortion is murder. And if abortion is murder, I'm not going to justify it, not going to accept it. Take a look at source number two. That was the position of Rabbi Feinstein. And that's what I meant when he said he tangentially deals with the issue of emotions in saying that's not justification here. He says, killing a fetus is prohibited until the doctors have great reason, close to certainty, that the mother will die. Since the permission is due to the fetus's status as a pursuer, the whole reason you're allowed to abort is to protect the health of the mother where you think the child is endangering the mother, it must be near certain that he is a pursuer, that in fact this would kill the mother. And that's part of a general rule that Rabbi Feinstein has, that if you think somebody poses a threat to somebody else's life, you are allowed to attack them to protect their victim. But he says you have to know for a fact that that's the case. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham is a remarkable figure in Israel today. He was the head of Internal Medicine Unit B at Shaarei Tzedek Hospital for many, many years. He's also an ordained rabbi. And he wrote literally the book on medical halacha. He put together a book which goes through the code of Jewish law and makes comments on it about where medical issues relate to whatever is in the code of Jewish law. It's actually available in English as well as Hebrew now. I'm told that the work is called Nishmat Avraham. And what he did was, on all the issues that came up, he consulted the leading rabbis of the time and collected their opinions. And he's a remarkable encyclopedia of knowledge. I've had cases where there were people who were dealing with health situations, and I was consulted, and I sent him the medical information. And he would email me back and correct the medical information that I was getting, and I would go back to the doctor and say, oh yeah, actually, yeah, that's right. The BUN can't be this, it has to be that. That kind of a response. That's the level of expertise you're dealing with medically, as well as in Jewish law. So, on this issue of the Tay-Sachs case, he quoted one of his mentors, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who passed away now about 10 years ago. And he said Rabbi Auerbach, who was a leading authority in Jerusalem, sided with Rabbi Feinstein except where emotional instability could threaten her life. That if the mother carrying this child to term could create a situation which endangered her life, then he believes that abortion would be justified. That's one end of the spectrum, the view that it's murder in general. The other end of the spectrum on this is Rabbi Waldenberg, and he wrote a responsum that he actually reiterated. He wrote this responsum basically five times. It comes up in his responsa because he was so challenged on this. It caused such heat. Take a look at source number three. He says, regarding abortion up to 7 months for a Tay-Sachs fetus, he says, it is clear and obvious as law that a Jew is not killed for aborting a fetus. There's no capital punishment. Aside from one view, the authorities rule there is a prohibition, but many authorities believe this prohibition is rabbinic, as it is under the issue of building the world, meaning that it's not good for the world to allow this, but it's a rabbinic prohibition. But there is no concern for destroying a life. He says it's not about murder. And therefore, he quotes an early authority named Maharit, who permits arrangement for a Jewish woman to abort a fetus where it is needed for the mother's health, even without it being a matter of saving the mother's life. And in such a case and beyond this, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, writing in the 18th century, permitted writing, and even with a legitimate fetus, there is room to be lenient for a great need so long as it has not been uprooted, meaning it's not beginning to be born, even without a need to save the mother's life, but only to save her from her evil, which causes her great pain. What he was dealing with, Rabbi Emden was dealing with another controversial case. It was a case of adultery. And now the mother is pregnant, and she wants to abort. So that was a case where Rabbi Emden was writing. But he says, we see clearly this permission of Rabbi Yaakov Emden is even when it is not a matter of saving the mother's life. It's only to save her from great pain from the child, and that in general there is room to be lenient for great need. Now, Rabbi Emden's response on this was very controversial. Basically, nobody else agreed with his leniency. But Rabbi Waldenberg quotes it, and he says, if so, ask yourself, is there any need, pain or ache, greater than in our case, which will cause, in the Tay-Sachs case, which will cause the mother in birthing such a creation, whose whole existence is suffering and pain, and whose death is certain in a matter of years, and whose parents watch and deteriorate without any power to save? And certainly it would not change or reduce anything if the child would be taken to a special institution without access for the parents until his death. He says that doesn't change the way he looks at it. And added to this are the suffering and pain of the child himself. And suffering and emotional pain in great measure are greater and more painful than physical pain. And on that basis, he allowed abortion up until the seventh month. Once the seventh month hits, he felt the fetus is viable, and therefore it's and therefore he couldn't justify it. Susan.
And say the pain and the suffering is so great. And because he's saying the fetus isn't viable for 7 months, which we now know is not true.
It's not about whether it's he's not making a medical statement when he said that. What you would need in order to determine viability, I mean, whatever, this is written in the early 70s. It's not, viability has shifted a great deal over the years. But in terms of your main point, he is combining two things, not just taking one point. His data points here are, number one, the point that you emphasize, which is the emotional pain and suffering that are involved, and physical pain and suffering along with it. And number two, the fact that he doesn't believe this is called murder at that stage. He's not going to apply that to the assisted death case. We're going to talk about assisted death. That's our topic for week four. So as long as we don't overrun too much with these other topics, we're going to get to talk about that. But that's his grounds for it. He doesn't take it lightly. I brought you a piece out of a long response. And like I said, he wrote this response in 5 times. Because he was challenged over and over, and he had to deal with the different challenges. This was a very controversial response, but I'm trying to show you the range. It's an orthodox response, meaning within the orthodox community, you had to take this very, very seriously, even if you were in Rabbi Feinstein's camp. Rabbi Feinstein, who normally addressed the sages he disagreed with great respect, including Rabbi Waldenberg, on this issue, could not bring himself to quote him by name. He said, I heard there is a scholar in Israel who has written because he was so, I mean, to him, this was murder. This is not something that you could just, you know, sort of say, well, okay, we have a disagreement. Brenda.
I just don't understand 7 months.
Neither do I.
Because any mother who has carried a child, and the child is kicking at, 5 months?
I mean, earlier than that.
Or whatever.
And the difference is only...
If that's not a light that's kicking you, what is that?
His answer will be that until it could survive out of the uterus, and again, the number's going to change over time with the advent of, number one, diagnostic technology to know its level of development, and number two, our ability to sustain a life outside once it's already emerged. But he's saying that at 7 months, this child could, if it were born, could survive, and that's what makes it an independent life, such that it will be subject to murder, as opposed to just saying it's a lesser prohibition. He's not disagreeing with the fact that there are signs of life beforehand, but the lack of independence is important to him as a threshold. That's where he's drawing the line. You're not going to find happy, you know, points of view here. There's no view here that you can look at and say, okay, that works. They're all going to be subject to problems. Let's look at the second case, which is the issue of the mother's emotional health. We have great precedent in Jewish law for taking emotional health very, very seriously. Example, the Talmud talks about putting out a fire on Shabbat for somebody who is suffering from depression and needs to just be alone and away, and the light is disturbing them. There's a lot of material on this. I gave a class on it a couple of months ago, and if I didn't put the link on the source sheet, I probably should have, on different ways that mental health and emotional health are looked at in Jewish law. But this even includes, relevant for the case at hand, acting prophylactically to keep somebody from developing a problem. Take a look at source number 4, which is a classic on this. Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein is a rabbi, a major authority in Jewish law in Israel today, and he talks about Rabbi Yitzhak Zev Soloveitchik, who was known as the Briska Rav. He was an authority first in Europe and then in Israel until he passed away in the 1970s. So Rabbi Yitzhak Zev Soloveitchik, the Briska Rav, told a doctor that saving a life is not specifically the case of someone who is now dangerously ill and will die. He's talking about Yom Kippur. Let me give the background. There was somebody who wanted to fast on Yom Kippur. And Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, the Briska Rav, was asked, and he said, "You're not allowed to fast. It's dangerous for your emotional health," given what he knew of his condition. He said, "It's dangerous for your emotional health." Doctor says to him, "It's not going to affect him. He'll be fine. He'll make it through and he'll be okay." And the Briska Rav's response was, "What about down the line? Is this potentially going to throw off his equilibrium? Not now, but years from now. Could there be an impact of it years from now?" And that's the excerpt that you're seeing here. He said, it's not just the case of someone who is now dangerously ill and will die. Even where the fast will affect him years later when the disease will recur. And so fasting, meaning now, will cause him to die early. This is, quote, saving a life. He is required to eat. Interestingly, there's a great ending to this story. The ending to this story is that the doctor comes back to him and says, "You're right. It could affect him down the line. But if you tell him now that he is in a position of danger that's such that he needs to eat, you're going to disturb his equilibrium worse at this stage." And on that basis, the Briska Rav recanted. He said, okay, that's a different story. That adds a factor that you need to know in order to give a proper answer. But that's the complexity of such situations. My point in bringing it is only to say the sensitivity to mental health as an issue, and emotional pain as an issue, goes beyond the immediate and includes the long term. So again, it depends on how I view the prohibition against abortion. If you view it as murder, then you require a very high threshold. It has to be the mother's immediate health, or the mother's health, I should say, not necessarily immediate. And based on that view, Rabbi Yisro Yehuda Unterman, we learned about him last year in our class on chief rabbis, so we talked about Rabbi Unterman at that point, was of the position that the only thing that would justify in terms of the mother's emotional health would be if she were suicidal. If there was a concern that she's suicidal, then that would be grounds to abort, but otherwise he said no. On the other hand, that brings in a new debate, which is, what if it is dangerous for her emotional health, but it's controllable with medication? So take a look at source number 5, the rabbi doctor who I quoted before, Avram Sofer Abraham, writes, the head of this person he was consulting was not observant. The non-observant head of a psychiatric department told me that he never recommends abortion for such a woman, for she can be treated with pills. And in the great majority of cases, the force of depression and irrationality after birth can be prevented. And so, hang on. And so a leading psychiatrist has told me. Based on this, so he continues to say, sorry, he continues to say, and so a leading psychiatrist has told me, based on this, it appears there is no permission to conduct abortion for a woman like this, and Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth, also authorities in Jewish law, agreed with me. He says, if it's controllable with medication, you don't have grounds for abortion. I am less comfortable with this. And the reason I'm less comfortable with it is because medication doesn't always work. It's a very, very tricky thing. It requires appropriate calibration for the person you're talking about. It requires that the person stick with the medication. Often a person in these conditions cannot bring themselves to do so for a variety of reasons. So just before I answer you, Judith, number 6, Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, who is another leading figure on the Israeli legal scene today, says, but it is clear that where there is emotional illness which cannot be treated with medicine, and it is caused by the pregnancy, then since emotional illness is generally considered a threat to life, she may abort her fetus to protect her life. And he notes, as part of the response, and I thought I had brought it here, but I didn't. I didn't bring it in this excerpt, that medication is not always reliably effective. So that's a major point, Judith, you were going to say?
Has there been consideration given to the fact that an unwanted child will have a home that doesn't want that child?
So I'm going to come back to that shortly. The question was, what about the concern that if indeed there was this desire to abort, maybe this indicates a problem in terms of the home that the child is going to be born into. What kind of a situation are you creating for this child? We're going to come back to this. They're not dealing with a case where that's going to harm the fetus. You are correct. Obviously, you have to be dealing with psychiatrists who are sensitive to the impact on the fetus as well, without a doubt. Yeah, Stephen, that was what you were going to say also. Okay. You cannot foresee. This is true for all areas of Jewish law. You're not expected to be a prophet. You're expected to do the best you can with the information you have. And frankly, the same thing is true in medicine. We get no guarantees. You work with the information you have, and you make your best judgment, and that's all you ever have.
But the abort on this thing alone, like as soon as the child was born, then they can keep the mother in hospital and assess.
And maybe that helps, and maybe that's ineffective. Right? Unfortunately, that's a reality. That the assessment, they may find that there aren't things that they can do for her. They may find that the medications they have are not working. You know, the technology is getting better, the medicine is getting better, but the reality is that in this area of halacha, in this area of medicine, medicine is way behind what it is in other areas. That's just the truth of it. It's still relatively primitive in terms of being able to identify what medication is needed for what person, and it's very person specific. And that's why you can't necessarily rely on it to be effective. Yeah, Stephen.
A mother on drugs.
Yeah. What about it?
Well, what is the situation now?
I don't understand the question.
The drugs are harming the mother and the drugs are harming the fetus.
True.
Is abortion preferred?
You need a whole lot more information on the case, meaning what are the options for weaning her from the drugs? What's the damage already done? Yeah. Right. No, all true. But the question, what you're asking fundamentally are variations on the Tay-Sachs question. These are all variations on that question, which require that you know the nuances of the case at hand. On the other hand, we've said, again, we're talking about the emotional health of the mother case, whether it's postpartum or whether it's the Tay-Sachs issue or any other. There are those who are very concerned for inappropriate applications of the permission we might give. Rabbi Shmuel Wozner dealt with this in the context of abortion of a fetus that is probably malformed. The doctors think, based on the ultrasounds, the fetus is probably malformed, and there's concern for the mother's emotional health. And he writes, were we to permit abortion for this, God forbid, we would be assisting sinners to be lenient in killing fetuses. For there is no cause to think this possibly life-saving. Calming her spirit and depression would be a mitzvah. He says, he'd rather see you make the effort to take care of the mother as opposed to opening the door for abortion where it's not needed. Take a look at source number 8. Number 8 is the last source I wanted to bring on this topic, from Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who passed away is now 3 years ago. He says, it is worth making clear, certainly to those who, in seeking a humane approach, are liable to adopt slavishly an overly liberal attitude in this area, that from the perspective of the fetus and those concerned with its welfare, liberality in this direction comes at the expense of humanity, insofar as the caution of the halakha is tied to its intimate concern for the values of kindness and mercy. It is not only the honor of God which obligates us, regardless of the cost, to avoid what is prohibited and to obey the commands of the Holy One, blessed be He, that are expressed in this halakha. It is also the honor of man in halakha, the humane and ethical element which insists on the preservation of human dignity and concern for human welfare, that rises up in indignation against the torrent of abortions. You may remember last week we opened with a quote from him, in which he said he's deliberately not giving precise rulings in this essay, because he said that you need to have flexibility realistically, you can't look at this topic, as he put it, as a human microcomputer. Here's the data, here's the conclusion. You have to have flexibility on it. He is of a lenient mind in many cases. But he says, this isn't only about, as he puts it, the honor of God here, it's the honor of man as well, and that includes the side of the fetus. If the halacha's course, he continues, is sometimes onerous for certain families or for those responsible for them, and this fact should neither be denied nor ignored, let us remember, paraphrasing the famous words of Byron, that halacha loved not the parents less, but the child more. This Byron quote, you have to remember, he also had a PhD in English literature from Harvard. He's going to quote Byron for you in an essay on halacha and abortion. But the point that he makes is you can't ignore the fetus in the desire to help the mother. And I thought I had brought more of the piece. I see that I didn't. But he talks about this issue of needing to encourage the creation of and enabling of adoption and homes for fetuses in case when they're born, they're no longer a fetus. But for children who are born into situations where it's not going to be a healthy environment for them. And that's also a much discussed topic, which is worthy of its own discussion, other than to note the most famous leader of the Jewish people was adopted. Right? The most famous Jewish leader of the Jewish people was Moshe, I think. He was adopted. Adoption has a very long and honored pedigree within Judaism. It should not be viewed, in any way as a second level type of a thing, even if it's not obviously what we wanted. Marlene and then Elaine.
Okay, two questions. So, along with this, what about birth control, and what about the day after.
Right. So these are good questions that are beyond the scope, meaning that it's true. These are good questions, and yes, they relate to the issue of production of life, but we will never get to any of the other topics if I take the different related areas. If I remember, what I will do later is send out in the follow-up email, so anyone who's not on the email list, make sure that you get on the email list, a link to a class that I did give on the contraception topic. It is worthy of its own discussion. And the link that I included on last week's sheet to my longer class on abortion, I dealt with the Plan B pill issue as well. A lot depends on the technology, meaning that there's a current system that is used that prevents conception. That's what they allege. That's what the science of it is supposed to be, that it prevents conception as opposed to aborting a conceived embryo. And there's a lot more grounds for using that than there is. It's basically another form of contraception as opposed to an abortion, even though it's happening after the fact.
Just one question. So is an Orthodox pharmacist allowed to...
So I've given class on that also, and it's a way... it's a good question. It's just beyond the scope of where we're going to go with this. Okay, she wanted to know if an Orthodox pharmacist would be allowed to dispense a Plan B pill that's going to be used in a circumstance where halacha would not approve it. It's a great discussion. I can send out a link for that one also, because it is a worthwhile question. Yeah, there's no room. We are starting the next series. Okay, we can discuss bioethics, believe me, today until tomorrow. For those of you who are interested, I will mention, if you're on my Beit Midrash's weekly email list, you'll see it. I give continuing education classes for medical professionals on these topics, usually about 8 or 9 times a year. There's one coming up on December 17th on Jewish law and the CPAP machine. That'll be at Shari Shemayim on Monday evening, December 17th. The issues of Shabbat and turning it on and turning it off and what's justified and how one does it and so on. There's a lot to talk about. Okay, let's get started on the cosmetic surgery topic. We'll get something in.
I forgot. It's another tangential topic.
Great.
But what about genetic counseling?
Also send out the link on that one. Okay, yes, I will send that out. Okay.